My name is Carla Mathis Lewis, and I'm the branch manager at the Gainsboro Branch Library. Today is March the 9th, 2009, and I am interviewing Sandra Smith Jordan. Good morning, Sandra.
Good morning, Carla.
Can you tell me where you were born?
I was actually born here in Roanoke, Virginia, at the old Borough Memorial Hospital. I was born December the 7th, 1948, to Lula, Virginia Campbell Smith. Campbell was her maiden name, and my dad's name was James William Smith, Sr. I say senior because I have a younger brother who is James William Smith, Jr.
How long have you lived in Roanoke, Virginia?
All of my 60 years. I turned 60 December of 2008, and I have actually loved and lived here all that length of time.
And what street did you live on?
I was actually born when they were living at 623 Loudoun Avenue. I now know that that was an area of town that very few blacks lived in, but that's where they were at the time when I was born. My dad worked at the flour mill that was over on Shenandoah, like two blocks away. And I always thought he actually worked in the flour mill and found out later in years he was the chauffeur of the man who owned the flour mill. So I was wondering how he got to drive some of them pretty cars, but I just thought he had money, you know. And my mom, she actually cleaned houses and, you know, worked for people that way. But with the snazzy clothes she wore, I thought she had a lot of money, too. But back then, I don't know. Roanoke, for me, growing up, was a magical place. Because I can remember on Henry Street, Sunday, that was showcase day. We would go and kind of line the street to watch the beautiful women in their hats and their beautiful dresses and the men tipping their hats to them and stuff. And all I could think of was, oh my goodness, I'd be glad when I'm old enough to do that. And never would I have imagined life would change for me, but it did. Integration hit Roanoke, and everything I thought to be true, I found out wasn't, you know. Segregation wasn't a bad thing for me, because everybody I saw was living well, doing well, from a child standpoint. I don't know what it actually was. And it was like the black teachers I had, these women carried themselves with such dignity and stuff. I always thought I wanted to be one. I had no idea that the life that I perceived the blacks in Roanoke to have was what the rest of the country was trying to get to. You know, we were like in this little balloon, I guess, or a little cocoon. Mm-hmm. And it just, when I heard about Carla, I was 40 years old before I found out that Danville, Virginia, only 75 miles away from us, was one of the biggest hot spots during civil rights time. And I considered myself to be an intelligent, you know, educated black woman, and I saw Eye on the Prize, PBS, and it blew me away. You only know the information somebody allows you to get your hands on. And since I had lived my whole life here in Roanoke, I didn't know how sheltered they had made this little valley. You know, they only let in what Roanoke Times and World News wanted you to see, and what the same people that owned the newspaper owned the media. If they didn't want it in here, you didn't know about it unless somebody from somewhere else did. So, yes, I love Roanoke. I've been here all my life.
Do you have any sisters or brothers?
I actually, and we're not talking about the siblings that came in my life after my father died. But my mother had 6 children. She had 3 by Purcell Johns, her first husband, and that would be Cody, Purcell Jr., and Johnny Johns. Then she had 1 by her second husband. His name is Walter Lester Jr., but we called him Booty. And then I came along. I was the 5th. And my dad is James Smith. That was Mom's 3rd husband. And 19 months after me, my baby brother. So she actually had 6 kids. And after, years later, I think I was about 13, she married her late husband, Wim Bowers. So she was Campbell Johns Lester Smith Bowers.
Okay. And your baby brother's name?
Is James Wim Smith Jr. He's my daddy's junior child.
Describe your house to us. Did you have a 2-story house, a brick house? Did it have a TV, telephone?
The house we lived in, 623 Loudon, it was a 2-story house. We had a nice backyard and front yard. Yes, we were one of the first to have a TV. My mom and dad, because of the jobs they had, like when the white people they worked for were going to get something new, they would either sell or give what they had to my parents. So we always had these nice things, and, you know, I'm like I said, I always just thought we had money, but it wasn't, you know. In this world, though, bartering is something that back in segregation time, you didn't really look at things from the money aspect of it. It's like, well, Carla, you know how to do such and such, and I know how to do this, so I'll do this for you, and you do this for me, and nobody ever talked about the money part of it. At least from a child standpoint, this is the way I perceived it. Where we lived at, like, Ford's gas station was right in the backyard from us. So I could go from my back porch down to Ford's, and they had everything little kids wanted. That's on one corner. Then on the next corner, it was, I think it was Mr. Moses' store. I'm not sure, but all this I could look out my back door, and it's right there for you. Not like today. You didn't have to go miles to get to the grocery store. You just come out your back door, and there you are. Down on 5th Street, it was a drugstore on one corner and a little grocery store on another. When it came to clothes and stuff, I just don't understand how our world got away from the neighborhoods. Because everything you wanted was in our neighborhood. Loudon Elementary School, right up the street, 2 blocks. And it's like, overnight, all of a sudden, as soon as I started school, okay, that was Loudon. That was my 1st grade. And, I mean, the teacher that I had, and I can't remember her name, but it was Coach Kennedy's last wife. And I wish I could remember her name, because that was the lady that
Dolly.
I emulated. Okay, she's still alive today. But
Dolly Kennedy.
She just, she had a way with kids that made you feel like you were special. Even if you were a little bad thing, she had a common effect to just, now come on, honey, you know that's not really what you want to do. And I'm going like, oh my goodness, that's what I want to be, just like her. And to this day, she tells me, you were one of the best students I ever had. Because really, as far as I was concerned, she was perfect, really. She was beautiful. She carried herself like she liked herself, you know. And it was like, well, this is what black women are supposed to be like. You know, everything in that neighborhood was wonderful for me But my mom and dad and their lifestyle, they divorced each other when I'm 2 years old. And my baby brother and I go to West Virginia to my dad's two brothers. I'm at one brother's house, and my baby brother's at the other one up the street, up the road. And my sister, she ends up in Northeast with my mom's mom. My two brothers, Johnny and Buddy, they end up in Bluefield, West Virginia. And my other brother, Booty, he ends up in Northeast with his grandmother. So we all over the map. I don't know what went on during the time we were away, but eventually my parents decided to get back together. And I'm thinking, oh, everything's right in the world again. By the time I'm 7 years old, 1956, a year that I thought would never end. So much crazy stuff happens. They get divorced in the second time. I mean, it's bad enough to go through a divorce one time with your parents, but to have them do that to you twice. Young kids today, they can think of a time when they were a child. I honestly can't. And the reason why I say that is because it seems like even before I was born, I was selected to watch over my mom. And I say it that way because when she was 3 months pregnant with me, they had to put her in the bed. She had to stay in the bed until I was born. After I was born, I can actually remember them putting me in the dresser drawer because there was no bed for me, but I had to be in the same room where she was. And I can remember that. And people tell me, no, you couldn't remember that. Kids don't remember. You need to be careful about what you say and do around young people. They can't articulate it, but they know what's going on. And I would tell mom and them years later about things that I remember going on in that room, and it's like, no, you were a baby. You don't know that. I said, then why are you getting so upset if I don't know that? I mean, when my mom would get in trouble, and she had a tendency of doing that because she wanted to be loved so badly, but she would always get mixed up with the wrong men. And I used to tell her, you know, I love you, I really do, but I need to tell you that you are a good example for me of what not to do. Because the men that you allow in your life, and you have children, the men that you have in your life, I wouldn't even give the time of day. So I appreciate you showing me what not to do. And it's not that I don't love you, it's just I'm having to love you for you. You know, I'm having to do your job for you. And my sister and my brothers used to always argue with me, who do you think you are? You can't talk to our mama that way. You can't treat our mama that way. I said, look, she's my mama too. And I'm sorry if you don't like it, but sometimes she needs to hear the truth. She doesn't need to be in no fabricated world that y'all people want her in. She needs to know when she's messing up as well as when she's doing something good. Well, if you live to be 18, I mean, I heard that so many times from especially mom's little buddies, because mom was, she would give you the shirt off her back if she considered you to be her friend. And when she needed help, they were never around. And even at a young age, I did not have a problem letting them understand, you need to understand something, that's my mom. And if you won't watch her back, I will. And bottom line, my future depends on how well I keep this lady stable. Because everything around her is unstable. And y'all keep telling me I won't live to be 18. If I let y'all run the show with her, I know I won't make it to 18. So when I step in, don't give me no flack. Because she needs me. And up until when she died last year, it was always that way. My main purpose on this earth turns out from my going back over my life of being there for her. When things turned around and her health went down, the only person that was there to help her want to stay here was me. I actually, the night that she died, I actually had to give her permission to go. Because they had diagnosed her 11 years earlier with Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And I kept trying to tell them, I don't think my mom has Alzheimer's. She is taking medication, and I used to be a pharmacist helper up at Super X, so the type of medication they had her on was the type that if she didn't take it, she should have died. That's how strong it was. And there were times when I knew she didn't take it right. And I'm saying, you know, you giving her medication for a heart problem, it's no way she could have that kind of a heart problem if the medication isn't administered right. You're giving her medications for cholesterol. You're giving her, it was 7 medications they had her on that she didn't need. But when you're on the wrong medications, you do end up with dementia. And she did have that. But Alzheimer's kills you. Dementia just makes you wish you were dead. And my mom had allowed my brother Johnny and his girlfriend to live in the house with her so she would have somebody there. But they were just living off of her. They weren't helping her. And she called me one day and she said, Sandra, I know you got your own problems, because I was already on disability by this time. She said, but they're calling me paranoid, and I don't think I am. And nobody is listening to me, and I need you to talk for me. And I'm saying to myself, she never asks me for anything unless she really needs it. So I better check this out. And I go up there, and she's telling me, somebody's coming and going in my basement door. And when I tell John and them about it, no, it ain't happening. And I went down to the basement door, and it was unlocked. And she said, she swore out she had locked it. What it was, my brother and his girlfriend were using that door coming and going and wasn't telling her. So this is, I guess, the Lord's way of getting me up there with her, because I ended up staying there during the day until my health went down. And she said, you know, I think you need to put me in assisted living, because I don't want you to kill your brother. And I don't want to kill him either. And Mom loved guns. And when she went into assisted living, that's the only way I got her doctor to understand they had on the wrong medication. Because those people were crushing her medication to get her to swallow it. And this is time-release medication. He took her off of that. Come to find out, the only thing she needed was blood pressure medication, and they didn't even have her on it. She got better, but not better enough that, you know, if they're going to label you with something, they're going to keep you on that label. And 11 years go by. But every day, unless I was sick, every day that woman saw me in assisted living and in the nursing home.
The assisted living place was in Greensboro?
No, the one up here on Williamson Road.
Okay, so it was here in Roanoke.
Yes, it's Roanoke assisted living now, but I want to say Lakeview. Is Friendship Manor owned it, but it's the one where they ended up having that flesh-eating disease. It came in a day after she had to go to the hospital for somebody hitting in her head. I said, well, thank you, Mama. You weren't there the night that this stuff broke out, because it wouldn't have affected you. It would have got me. You know what I'm saying? But she went from the hospital into Friendship Manor. But the night she died, when I got to the hospital, I mean, when I got to the nursing home, they had just fed her. And I knew she didn't look right. And she was so happy to see me, and the girl grabbed a tray and went out. And I'm looking at it, and I'm a little puzzled. And I said, Mama, do you need to go to the bathroom? And she let me know, yes. Well, as I'm taking her to the bathroom, and I got ready to put her on the toilet, she said, no, real loud, real strongly that, no, don't do that. And I said, okay. I said, what's wrong? And she started regurgitating. I knew then it was food poisoning. But they try and tell me, oh, no. I said, look, I've had food poisoning. Whatever you fed her, and they had given her chicken that had set out too long. Well, this is at 6 o'clock. From 6 o'clock until almost 11:30, I was there administering to her. Couldn't get no help from nobody. Well, she just got to do what she got to do. A brother, baby brother, Jimmy, came in. He's helping me. But both of us are so drained that by 11:30, I really had to go home. And he's also on disability himself, and he was feeling the effects. And I told Mom, I said, you know, every day you wait until I can get to you, and I love you for it. But I need you to understand something. If they wait until I leave tonight and they put you in the hospital, every time you've had to go to the hospital the past 2 years, I've made it there somehow to be with you, but I won't be able to make it tonight. I said, if you are tired, at the rate these people are treating you, and I see you every day, at the rate that it's going, I might end up in the ground before you do.
I gave her permission to die.
It's all right, Sandra.
I told her that if she was tired, she should go ahead and go to sleep. And she went to sleep. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, they called me to tell me she was gone. And I know it was best for her and for me, but it still hurts. Because she went through all this stuff during her life. And I know everybody has their own path to go. But it still, it hurts. And it's really fascinating that I'm 60 years old. And yet and still, the majority of my life was revolved around taking care of her or my siblings or somebody else. And I'm just now getting to a point where I'm taking care of me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's it's fascinating. I wake up every morning and I look out my bathroom window and I see the Blue Ridge Mountains. And the only thing I can think of is, man, you live in a wonderful place.
because if I'm sad, the mountains say to me, but it's going to be okay. If I really get angry, pissed off, I go up to Mill Mountain Star and I yell my head off. And then I look down at the little teeny cars and trucks and it's like, well, when you were down there, it felt really bad, didn't it? And now you're up here in God's country and it's like, okay, all right. You let it go, so that's the end of that part of it.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about your school. And you started out talking about your elementary school.
Yes.
So you went to elementary school?
At Loudoun Avenue. And that was, I lived in six, that was in the 800 block of Loudoun. Now, I'm not sure if the reason I ended up at Harrison was because my mom and dad divorced, and she had what was called primary custody, and her address was Rutherford. Mm-hmm. Or because I was still living on Loudoun with my dad. So I would walk from Loudoun Avenue over to Harrison. My mind says that the summer between first grade and second grade is when they tore down Loudoun Avenue. I mean, I can't find anybody to justify that date for me. I do remember the summertime they had painted the school and got it all ready for the next year, but it was never next year. So I don't know if that's actually when integration stuff started rolling or what, but I do know I couldn't go back to that school, and I ended up at Harrison. And I went to Harrison School from the second grade through the sixth grade.
Okay. And then you went to?
Booker T. Washington Junior High School. And I say it that way because that was, you know, I told you I had all these wonderful anticipations about becoming of age, you know, being able to go to Henry Street's nightclubs, the Ebony Club, and all this other stuff. And once you got to Booker T, that was your introduction to becoming an adult, you know. That's when we had our socials, and it was just a sign of, you know, you've made it through this, now you're coming to this part of it. And it was teachers there that would actually talk to you like you were a person, like Ms. Deskins, for instance. I will always be grateful to this lady because my mom never talked to me about things like menstruation, how girls are supposed to mature. I was in a household full of men, you know, brothers. All I was there for was taking care of everybody else. But Ms. Deskins talked to me as woman to woman. She talked to me like she knew I was going to be somebody. So here's another teacher in my life that made me feel like maybe I should be a teacher, you know, because my first grade teacher, she carried herself in a way that, yeah, I'd like to be like that. And then here's Miss Deskins talking to me in a way that, not down to me, but the fact that she respected the fact I had a brain, I had something to say, and she was willing to listen. And then I had the opportunity of being in the choir with Miss Hunt. Now you're talking about a woman that could make you feel like you were better than what you thought. That woman, she could listen to your voice. Oh, you should be a soprano. Oh, your voice is changing. We're going to make you a second soprano. And I'm going like, well, you ain't heard me sing yet. And it's like, No, hon. I've been doing this long enough where, I mean, those are the kind of teachers that I had at Booker T. Washington. And I thought all was right in the world. But this is still segregation time, okay, for me. Come the summer after the eighth grade, and I get this notification. Now, we had moved from Rutherford Avenue to 22nd Street in a predominantly all-white neighborhood. And I had never heard a person use the word nigger before, like white people use, until we moved up there. And this letter says that due to your address, you will not be going to Lucy Addison, which that's where you went to in the ninth grade back then. You will be going to Monroe Junior High School on 19th Street. Well, I didn't know what hell was until that year. And the very first day of school, there is this table out front with people from the health department. No, it's the second day of school. And the first day of school, they had allowed one little white girl in the school that had lice. The second day of the school, they got the health department up there. Now, black kids don't get lice, okay? But they got this long table, and they had these little people on either side that tells you you got to go to this table. And they got this man on the other side of the table with this long nozzle, and he goes, he's shooting some kind of powder in your hair, in your pubic area, under your arms. Any place there may be hair, they're delicing you, as he says. And I said, but excuse me, how do you know I got lice? He said, it doesn't matter. The school's been infested. I said, this is second day of school. What do you mean? What do you mean talking back to me, nigga? And I'm going like, we ain't in Kansas no more, is we? They did not allow us to go home. We had to sit in that school for the school day with this pad on us. That was my first experience with being around white folks. And I'd been around white folks with the ones my mom and them worked for. But I hadn't been around these kind of white folks. Okay. And, okay, I'm surviving that and get into the second week of school. Now, Miss Deskins had been my gym teacher. And I didn't know how good we had it at Booker T because we had the stalls that, you know, went all the way down to the floor. Okay, what you did in yours was private, put it that way. And she always told us to use our little flip-flops and to take care of yourself and protect yourself. I get up there, and they have the stalls that, you know, the bottom part of it, what's in one can go into the other. I got on everything I ever used at Booker T, and I get athlete's feet from the girl in the other stall. Because the stuff over her nasty feet pop onto my little clean feet and my flip-flops, and I get athlete's feet. It's the second week of school. It is so bad for me. I don't have an immune system to combat white people's germs because I've never been around them. They had to put my feet in what they call mini cast to save my toes. And I had to be educated at home for 8 weeks. Athlete's feet. I mean, it blew my mind. And I'm saying, well, maybe they won't make me go back to school. Well, as soon as the doctor releases me, I got to go back to school. Well, it's like, what else? And be careful of what you ask, okay? Because when I said, what else can happen to me after this, I had no idea what was coming down the pipe. I was in school for less than a month, and they let this little kid come back to school with what they call the kissing disease, but what is mononucleosis. And for me, that diagnosis meant being in the hospital for close to a month, had to have 2 spinal taps to save my life, ended up being paralyzed for 2 weeks because they nicked my spinal column with one of those needles. And to have the doctor tell my mother, well, I'm sorry, but she will never be able to hold down a job. She will never be able to have children. You will be lucky if she makes it to be an adult. And I'm going like, what is this? Somebody's joke? You know, here I am in the 9th grade, and just because I'm made to go to school around these people, I got to be punished like this? I don't think that's fair. And I decided after that, I ain't taking no more of this stuff. I had a very short time back in the school before the end of the year, but I had an English teacher. Now, I loved English because of the teachers that I'd had in the past. I had an English teacher to tell me, if you get anything out of this class, you'll be lucky. And she gave me her teacher's medal. I still have it today. She said, if you learn anything, you better use this, because this is the only way you're going to get it. And she really did me a favor, because I used it even when I went to college. I used her little book, and I gave it to my sister when she went to college, and I've given it to other people for them to use. So I'm glad she did give me her little book. But she and the other teachers definitely let me know, we ain't teaching you nothing. She had the audacity to tell me, hey, you niggas wanted what we got, now get it the best way you can. And I told her, hey, it's nothing that you people have that I want. The court system said I had to come here. I wanted to go to Addison. I was an honor student before I came up here. I was supposed to be having Algebra 2. You tell me you don't get Algebra 2 until you get in high school. So you give me something called new math that you people didn't even know what it was. Half the answers in the book were wrong. Well, see, y'all want what we got. I said, no, ma'am, I'm sorry. It's not anything y'all have that I would ever want, but whatever. Y'all do the best you can. Do you remember Judge Ballou? He was the head judge over all the judges downtown. This is when the municipal building used to be the courthouse and the jail. And my first interaction with him was that summer after the 9th grade. I told my mom, I said, look, I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. I know that by law I'm supposed to go to school. But I want you to honestly know I will leave your house every morning like I'm going to Wimpton. And I will come back every evening like I went to that school. But honestly, I'm going to be able to find me a job somewhere because I'm not going to that school. And she says, so what do you want to do? I said, the law says I got to go, but I'm not going to. She said, well, then the law is going to have to tell you where you can go. I said, well, I want to go to Addison. She said, well, okay, fine. So she got a lawyer. We went before Judge Ballou. And he said, you need to explain to me why you're in front of me. And I said, I'm in front of you because the law says I have to be. He looked at me and he said, do you know who I am? I said, no, who are you? He said, can't you read? And I looked at his little sign in front of him. I said, you're Judge Ballou. How do you do? Well, I do fine. And who are you supposed to be? And I said, my name is Sandra Lee Smith. That's who I am. And I guess I'm in front of you because the law says I have to go to William Fleming High School. And I say, I will leave my mama's house every day like I'm going. I'll come home every evening like I went. But I'm not going to William Fleming High School. And I told him what I just told you about what I went through at Monroe. And he just sat there and calmly looked at me. And he said, you know what you want, don't you? I said, no, I know what I need. And I don't need to be around, excuse my French, any more of you white people. I just, my body won't survive the issue. And he looked at me and he said, well, you might be right. Because I've never heard of somebody going through as much medical trauma as you went through. Not even a year. He said, so, if I let you back in at Lucy Addison High School, what are you going to do? I said, what do you want me to do? He said, I want you to be the best student you can be. Can you do that? And inside, I'm saying to myself, this man is going to let me go. This man is going to let me go back to Lucy Addison. Yes. And evidently, he could tell it from my body reaction. And I said, for you, yes, I will be the best student I could be. And he said, okay, all right, here you go. He signed my little petition and gave me permission to go, and I'm elated. But to show you how quickly things change, in less than 3 weeks after that first visit with him, my mom had to have an emergency hysterectomy. Well, she was married to a 100% disabled veteran, and she was his legal guardian. And anytime she could not be in charge, somebody else had to be made his guardian. Well, here I go back before Judge Ballou because I presented such a strong case for myself before. At 15, I become my mom, my baby brother, and my stepfather's guardian. And I had to be given a special driver's license. So, Judge Ballou says, you know you're going to have to drive your mom's car. I said, well, to be honest with you, I've never had driving. I'm only 15, can't have it. He said, no. I make that determination. He said, I'm going to send you to get the driver's test. I'm going to allow you X number of days to study. If you pass the test, I'm going to give you a license. And I'm saying to myself at 15, yeah, right. Well, I took the test, I passed the test, so at 15 I had a driver's license. And I'm my mom's guardian, and I'm my stepfather's guardian, and I'm my baby brother's guardian. So I'm running everything.
Were you allowed to go to school?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And see, when I was at Booger T, I liked it so much, I went to summer school. Okay? Mm-hmm. Well, by the time I got to 10th grade, I actually had enough credits to graduate. But nobody told me that you had to have 11th and 12th grade English, government, and U.S. history. If I had known that, I would have taken those during summer school, and I could have graduated in 10th grade. But since they didn't tell me that, I had to go to school to take those courses. Well, because I really didn't have but certain mandatory electorates that I had to take, the rest of the time was like taking typing and stuff like this. And the other kids couldn't understand, well, why is it Sandra doesn't have to take tests like we do? Well, Sandra's been typing up your tests, so she can't take the same test that you take. So the teachers would orally give me my tests. And, well, my 20th class reunion, I found out what my nickname was with the other kids. They used to call me Little Old Lady. And now I understand why, you know, but... Well, you used to drive to school. Nobody else could drive to school, and you used to this and you used to that, and well, you do what you have to do. You know what I'm saying? But
well, when did you fit college into graduating? Well, not graduating in 10th grade, but completing 10th grade and maybe the 11th grade, because
no, I finished high school.
You finished high school.
Yep. Okay. When I was. I got pregnant right before my senior year started. And right toward the end of the year, well, in March of the next year, I'm about ready to deliver my baby. And Mr. Phillips and I had already set up everything for me to graduate, but Mr. Coleman, the assistant principal, decided to pick a fight with me. I did not like his attitude. And did nobody tell you to lay down and get pregnant? And I told him, I said, you know, I'm not sure how you got your job, but you really don't have the right personality for it. And because of you, I would like for you to send my money for my gown, pictures, dues, whatever else I've given you money for, back to my mom's house because I won't be graduating from this school. And he did not allow Mr. Phillips to know that we had had that argument until after graduation. And Mr. Phillips did not know what had happened. And he convinced me to go back to summer school to take my last two credits, and I did, and graduated from summer school. But no, I wasn't gonna let that man keep me from graduating. It was just, no, you don't talk to me that way, especially not when I'm getting ready to deliver a baby. No, emotional all over the place.
So, and then after you had your son, is it?
Yes, that was James Clinton Smith. That was my first son. Well, to be honest with you, I did not decide to go to college until, I think I was 32 years old, 31, 32 years old. And this is after losing a child, having another child, being married, and then divorced. And I have to credit for me going to college because they had this JUMP program, J-O-M-P, I think. And one of their directors used to be a regular customer of mine at Super X Drugs on 19th Street. And she just kept telling me, I think you would really do good in college. And I said, well, what am I going to go to college for? I'm already a mother, two kids, and blah, blah, this and that and the other. And she said, but I really think you have something that you need to finish, don't you? And I'm going like what? She said, I don't know. What did you think you wanted to do when you were in school? And I said, well, while I was in school, I had been taking a stenotype course through the mail, and I always thought I might want to be a stenotypist in the court system. And she said, did you finish it? And I said, no, I got pregnant and didn't get a chance to finish it. And she said, well, they have that course out at Virginia Western. why don't you finish that? And then from see what you might want to do after that. And I'm going like, well, you know, I do books for Super X and stuff, and that takes up a lot of my time. She said, no, seriously, just think about it. Well, I decided to take that little course to see if I was college material. And I aced that. And I'm going like, that wasn't so hard. And she said, well, that's what I'm trying to get you to understand. It's not as hard as people want you to think it is. So we went out to Virginia Western, and I rolled out there under their secretarial sciences course. But the lady who was supposed to be teaching the court stenographer course left the area. So instead of just dropping out, I went on and finished a year. Then I transferred to National Business College because they did have the course. And that was a pretty good experience for me. But the manager that I had at Super X, because this little black girl was going to college, decided he was going to cut my hours. And he cut them all the way down to 9 hours a week. And I told him, look, I need you to understand something. I'm not trying to better myself to go after your job. If I wanted anybody's job, it would be your boss's job, not yours. I said, you need to understand something here. I'm raising two sons, and I cannot do that all for 9 hours a week. Well, you need to drop out of school. I said, and who are you to tell me what I'm supposed to do? I said, now, the last election, you almost got your ass whooped by me, because this man waits until 6 o'clock knowing that the polls closed at 7. He leaves the store, and the only person there other than the pharmacist is me. So I couldn't leave until he came back. He comes back 5 minutes after 7, knowing I could not go to the election polls, knowing how I felt about that. And at first, I was going to lay his butt out, but I had people, who customers, who knew how I felt about me voting. And they laid into this man where I didn't have to say a thing, okay? But when he did that, the manager up at Dan Hale, he was the manager up at Kentucky Fried Chicken, he offered me a job up there. And he said he would work my hours around me going to school. So I quit Super X. I went up there. I ended up finishing my court stenography class and stuff at, well, it was legal secretary, what I ended up getting an associate degree as. But Judge Ballou again intervenes in my life, because every day we had to go to his court, you know, for practice. He pulled me to the side one day and he said, Sandra, let me ask you something. I've been in your life for a long time. He said, I know you love the Roanoke Valley. I said, yeah, I do. He said, well, you are aware that once you get your degree with this court stenography course, that you're probably going to have to relocate to Richmond, D.C., one of the larger areas. We've got two ladies here that have been doing this for the past 20 years, and they're not ready to retire. And we don't have openings for new people. And I said, really? Well, why didn't you tell me that a long time ago? And he said, hey, I didn't think you were, you know, according to the doctors, you weren't supposed to be able to have kids or anything. So I didn't think you were going to stay in the valley. And I said, well, what do you suggest I do? He said, well, instead of court stenography, why don't you transfer it to legal secretary? You can still use, you know, that kind of shorthand. But there are plenty of jobs around here for legal secretaries. So through his guidance again in my life, I was able to change, you know, what I was doing. But, you know, it shows you how you might have one bad white person, then you got a good white person. And it depends on the person, regardless of the color. So I ended up get my degree as a legal secretary. And I've used the, what do you call it? I've used what I learned, but I found out that just because you get a degree is one thing, that's not necessarily what you're supposed to do. Because I ended up being a district manager at the Roanoke Times and World News. And growing up in Roanoke, you know, the Roanoke Times and World News ain't had nothing good to say about black folks. But here I am, a disgruntled parent. Now, I had already passed the state board for an insurance agent. So I'm an insurance agent for North Carolina Mutual. Had no intentions of working at the newspaper. But my son gets a paper out. His district manager messes over him. They send a letter saying they taking my son and me to court. They're going to sue us for the money he supposedly owes. Well, hey, I'm a bookkeeper. Don't you think I'm keeping my son's records? So I take the records down to the office and I show this man why my son doesn't owe this money. And he says, can you hold on just a minute? And he goes get his boss. And they come back and, are you looking for a job? I said, do I look like I'm looking for a job? I came down here to do you a favor. I want you to understand I don't owe this money. You can take me to court if you want to, but Judge Ballou and I are very good friends. I'm trying to do you a favor. Yes, ma'am, and you're doing a very good job because after reviewing your records and stuff, we find out we owe you X number of dollars back because your son never got his discounts for paying on time and blah, 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 and all this stuff. I said, well, thank you. I appreciate that. I can use the money for gas. No, seriously, would you like a job? I said, no, I wouldn't. I already have a job. But this is a part-time job. It will only take a few hours a day, and it's in such a small area, blah, blah, and all this stuff. And I said, just trying to be nasty, okay? I said, yeah, right. Sure, I want your job. I mean, I wasn't saying I want a job. I'm just saying I'm a black person and you offering me a job? This is Roanoke Times and World News. Yeah, sure. And the next day, I get a call saying, we need you here by 4 o'clock to sign your papers. And I'm going like, sign my papers for what? You accepted our job yesterday. So here I am. I'm an insurance agent. Got too many things to do to begin with, because as an insurance agent, me and my big head, the so-called supervisor I had didn't like the fact that I didn't like to sell insurance. And I had offered to quit a couple of times. I actually threatened to quit. And the guy from Durham, North Carolina, comes up here and says, look, if we enlarge your collecting route, would you stay on as a collecting agent and you only sell if you want to sell? I said, okay, because I didn't realize that they have what is called an arrearage, which means people that stay behind on their insurance, they expect for it to be like 40 to 50%. Well, mine was like 9%. I had no idea that that was such a big thing, you know? And he says, but because you're going to be a collecting agent, the 300 and some people that you have, your book will actually be 1,500 policyholders. I said, how do you expect for me to deal with 1,500 policyholders in a month? He said, but you don't have to sell. You just have to keep what you got. Well, here I am with this great big collecting book. And now I got this part-time job at Times and World News. that's when I learned that prayer works, okay? Because I told the Lord, I said, you know what? I have worked jobs making less than $5,000 a year. And they took a lot of work. And if you help me figure out a way to intertwine these things, I think I could do it. Because they were in the same area, mostly where I grew up, Northwest Roanoke. Well, what I did was to use the post office, get a lot of rolls of stamps. And I went to each and every one of my customers that I knew didn't necessarily need me to collect. And I let them know they would be doing their agent a wonderful favor if they would mail the money to her, because they used checks. And the ones who didn't use checks, I did continue to see them. But out of 1,500 people, I only personally had to collect from 150 people. The rest of them did their agent, who they liked, a wonderful job of mailing the money to me. And since the newspaper paper routes were in the same area, when I needed a carrier for the paper route, I just took my little butt out there delivering papers. What is my insurance agent doing out here? My son needs a job. Can you give him a job? I said, is he 12 years old? He's 13. Is he willing to listen and take instruction? If he gets it from you, yes. I said, well, yeah, I'll give him a job. I'll give him a try. I mean, when you pray, the man always comes through, especially if your name is Sandra. He's always watching my back, so what can I say?
That's wonderful. Okay, Sandra. When you were small, even when you were in high school, where did you buy your clothes? Were you able to go to the shops downtown?
To be honest with you, mm-hmm. most of my stuff, my sister Cody, it was hand-me-down stuff. I don't remember us actually, as you say, going shopping. And she probably did, but for me, no. When I got pregnant with my first child, my mom was going to buy me this maternity dress that she saw down at Hieronymus. It was $85 for one dress. And I looked at it and I said, no disrespect, but I'm not going to be pregnant forever, you know? So I tell you what, you give me $85 and take me to the fabric place, and I'll use grandma's sewing machine, and I bet I can make me enough for the whole pregnancy. And I got this one pattern, a simplicity pattern that had the slacks with the stomach cut out, the skirt, the shorts, and the top. And then I got one pattern that looked like the dress she was going to buy. And that one tent dress, I made it out of this real soft wool. I lined it because I'm allergic. And it had a roll. Girl, you couldn't tell me nothing, okay? I thought I was the prettiest pregnant person in the world when I put on that dress. And I made three different color tops, same top, just different colors. The shorts, the long pants, and the skirt. And people thought I had all kinds of outfits just because I switched them up. And it cost less than $80 for making all of that.
Okay.
And I had no idea I could sew. I mean, I used to make stuff for my little dolls, but I really didn't know that I could sew. But like the lady at the fabric shop told me, if you can read instructions, if you can follow instructions, you can sew. It's just the test of your patience. I said, well, hey, I got plenty of patience, so yeah, I guess I can sew.
Sandra, what is your fondest memory of during childhood?
When Henry Street was at its best time for me was when you could go to the movie theater and go across the street to the little store and get this 5-cent sucker that would last you for days, okay, and it only cost 5 cents. You could get your hot dogs in the movie theater. Vanette's, do you remember him? Little restaurant. That man made some of the best food. I know I had to be 6, maybe 7, because my brother Johnny got a paper route. And his paper route was actually Gilmer, the street over from that, Loudon Avenue, adjacent to Henry Street, and Henry Street. That was his paper route. Now, a lot of people would have thought, that's too dangerous. You don't want that. Well, he carried Gilmer and the next street over. I carried Loudon Avenue and Henry Street. And I know that the Lord is always watching over me because there were people who other people would cross the street. Okay, they did not want to be around them because they considered them dangerous. They would walk me and make sure that I was safe. I had people with their lights on because they knew this was the time of morning that this little girl would be bringing that paper. And when we got through carrying the papers, now Van Ness was Gilmer and Mormon Road, that little area. He had his little restaurant there. As soon as we passed there, they would have me breakfast waiting every morning.
That's wonderful.
I mean, that's my favorite memory because that was showing me how people really cared about Sandra.
Mm-hmm. Your favorite gift?
I'd have to say it was my first child. And the reason why I say that, I had gotten to a point in my teenage years of being really disappointed in the world around me. So I had gotten suicidal. And I had a real frank conversation with the Lord up on Mill Mountain. And I told him, I said, you know, if this is all it is, I really don't want to be here. So if you want me here, you're going to have to give me a reason to stay. Because the stuff at home with my stepmother and my mother, it was just, I was sick and tired of being everybody else's caregiver. You know how you get sick and tired of being sick and tired? Well, I was. And a friend of mine, Ronnie Gravely, and I used to race cars together. I used to race cars. And he was having trouble with his girlfriend who had run off. I was having trouble with my boyfriend who went into the Air Force. We kind of crying on each other's shoulders. And we went to the Lehigh Drive-In. And Paul Newman and Harper was playing. And we consoling each other. And I had never let anybody touch me sexually. And we did. And I knew at that moment I was pregnant.
Okay.
And everybody acting like, no, you didn't know. I knew. I knew I was pregnant. Telling myself, no, you couldn't be because this is the only time you've done it, so no, you can't be. I was. And with all the stuff that I went through, because it was an atopic pregnancy, it was in my tubes, and I should have died according to the doctors. But with all that went down to get him into the right place, because they were giving me birth control pills to push him out. And the 3 dosages is what it takes. the first doses, it felt like somebody had their hand in my, and I'm going like, I ain't taking this no more. Well, the second dosage, it was worse, except in a different place. And something told me, you know, man upstairs, when they got ready, gave me the third pill, I said, I'm not taking that pill. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. I said, no, I'm not taking that pill. And by not taking that pill, he ended up in my room in the right place. And, well, I knew I went into labor in March. The hospital said, no, you're not in labor. You got this much more to go. I said, I don't care how much more I got to go. My water broke. I'm in labor. My son was born April the 11th by an emergency C-section. I should have died. He should have died because they let me fall out of the bed in the hospital. And Dr. Law told my mom, she won't make it. And the baby's probably already dead. And my mom told him straight up, either one of them die, I'm going to sue you for everything you got. So the Lord said, no problem. As soon as that child hit air, they heard him all over the hospital. And that was my best friend until he died at age 25. So my favorite memory is that young man coming into my life. Taught himself how to use the bathroom. Started talking at 8 months, walking at 8 months. He answered the phone telling people, Sandra's not here, call back. I mean, that's my favorite memory.
Okay, that's beautiful. Tell me what you think about the public library, Mrs. Lee, if you remember her, the library today.
I remember the library from the time that I was probably 8, 9 years old, because I was at Harrison, and this is after I had been forced to move from Loudoun to live on Rutherford with my mom. And my grandmother lived in the 400 block of Rutherford. And my grandmother would take the bus from downtown. She worked at the State and City Building as an elevator operator. When she'd take the bus, she'd come by here. A lot of times she would stop and come by the library. And my way of being able to spend time with her, more time with her, I would come from Harrison down here. Miss Lee would sit and talk with me or spend time with me. And when Grandma would get off the bus, she'd come in, they talk, we talk, and then I'd leave with my grandma. So Gainesboro Library really has been in my life for a long, long time. And Miss Lee, well, she was like a surrogate mom, but she was like it for anybody that needed it. But I liked her because, just like Miss Deskins, she talked to me as a person, not a little kid, not somebody that didn't have an opinion, but somebody that she could exchange thoughts with. I mean, this library really, it's not like the other libraries in Roanoke. This is a community space. This is a home place. That's the reason why I was really pleased that they, when you expanded it, you tied it all into the main place. You know what I mean? Because this was a little teeny little thing to begin with, but now it's, well, it's just like your heart, you know. You use it enough, it grows. That's what I call it, yeah. Heart of the community. A place where if you want to get in touch with the community, this is the only library I tell you to come to. learn a whole lot here.
Who were some of the strong community leaders?
Coach Candidate. That was, maybe it's because he married my first grade teacher, I don't know. But Coach Candidate and I, up until the day he died, I don't know if I ever had a class with him or not. I'm not exactly sure why he and I were always so close. But if I ever needed a father figure to talk to, he was just always somebody watching over me. But in my lifetime, seriously, the black teachers that I had, whether they were actually a teacher of mine or just in my life through school, I never really had a bad one. And maybe that's just me, because if you didn't come across right to me, I didn't have a problem letting you know. I'm sorry, you're messing up. I didn't have a problem letting you know why. And for whatever reason, because I was able to do that, I always had a good rapport with the teachers. Not so much with the kids, because they got on my nerves. I'm going to tell you, you know you ain't supposed to be drinking. You know it makes you sick, but you're going to do it anyway. I mean, just because I had my driver's license early, I was the designated driver for all the so-called hip kids. Like, you know, y'all are so boring. You really are. Well, don't you want to smoke? No. Well, don't you want to drink? No. Well, what do you want to do? I said, hey, get you out of my face, really. Take you home. And you go on and puke into the toilet and stuff. Not my cup of tea. I actually smoked a cigarette one time and it knocked me out for 15 minutes. A group of us decided that we were going to buy a pack of cigarettes to see how it would do. And I said, well, if we're going to spend our hard-earned money, we're going to get a real cigarette. So we got a pack of those short Campbells. And it knocked me out for 15 minutes. And I said, I tell y'all what, y'all do what you want to do, but I ain't burning my money up, especially for something that could knock me out. I don't think so.
How has Roanoke changed in your years?
Oh my God. I actually can remember picnics and family dinners at my grandmother's house in Northeast.
Okay. Your grandmother's name?
Lula Turner Campbell. And I want to say it was Gilmer School that was right across in front of her. I'm not sure which elementary school was there, but she had a school right across the street from her house. And on the corner was the rec center. And all of this is right in spitting distance of my grandmother's front porch. And because of the blue law, on Sunday, that's when everybody got together. Because there wasn't no malls, there wasn't no stores open. Everything was done Saturday night so that you could be together Sunday. Because that was your entertainment. And, I mean, I could walk from my mama's mother's house around to Rutherford Avenue, where the post office is now, to my daddy's mother's house. And nobody would mess with you. And I mean, I had to be a real young person during this time. I can remember when they told those people, you gotta move. It wasn't no negotiation. It wasn't no trying to give them a good price for their property. It was, you got to move, bye, get out.
Was that in North?
That was Northeast. And I remember when my grandmother moved in the 400 block of Rutherford Avenue. That was the transition. She had been in that house until I was maybe the 7th or 8th grade. And that's when they came through again with this, you got to move. We're going to make improvements in Gainesboro. We're going to remove the hills of Gainesboro. And that's when they came in and destroyed Gainesboro. What you see today is what they did. Okay? And my grandmother had to move from Rutherford up off of Melrose on Palm. And eventually that's where she died, but she died on a mortgage on the house because she had just got through paying for the one in Northeast. They moved them out. She just got through paying for the one on Rutherford, and they moved them out. So, you know, Roanoke has gone through so many changes in my lifetime. But I would say in the past 5 years, for the most part, they've been doing things that are not so bad. Like the greenways, for instance. I live on a street where Lick Run, the greenway for that is. And I can remember 15, 20 years ago when they were starting to try and get the connection between Valley View and over there done. And I helped a little bit with that. But I see more, I see better things now than the stuff they used to do in the past.
Okay, jobs. What kind of jobs, when you were growing up, what kind of jobs were available to...
When I was pregnant in the 12th grade, I had a part-time job at JCPenney. When, after I had my child, I got a job at Halmode Sewing Apparel down here on Center. And because of the dust, I ended up with an eye infection, so I had to leave there. And I went from Halmode to First National Exchange. They had a check processing division out on Plantation Road, and I worked there, but you couldn't leave until all the checks were processed. And I was there one night from like 2 in the evening until 2 in the morning. And this is with a young son at home. And I said, no, I can't deal with this, because that night I was almost abducted by this man that was going along 581 killing women. And luckily, like I said, the Lord's always watching over for me, but luckily, I had talked to a police officer earlier that day. They gave me a description of the car and said he's passing himself off as a police officer. And if he gets out of his car, you don't get out of yours, and you pull off until you get to an area where people are. Mm-hmm. And when I did that, the guy didn't follow me. And I knew that... somebody was watching over me, okay? After I was at First National Exchange, I got a job at Super X for the first time. And that's when I was doing their books and cashier. But Allstate had asked me to work there. So I left Super X and went to Allstate. And while I was there is when I had my last child. So after I had him, the doctor didn't want me to work anymore. So about 5 years, I was at home. And then they wanted me to come back to Super X to straighten their books back out. So I went back to them until I went to college. And then I ended up with the insurance, mm-hmm. and then at the newspaper. Okay. But I'm going to tell you, when he wants you not to do something, he works things out, because Roanoke Times had devised a plan to get rid of people 40 years old or older who had worked for him for 10 years or longer. And I had no idea how devious white people are. You know, I had forgotten because I worked down there and thought I was friends with these people or whatever. But business is business, as they say. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want me down there. So they worked a way out that they ended up getting me losing my disability with Social Security. Plus, I couldn't get benefits with them because they didn't give me enough hours. And when they decided, okay, we'd have messed her up enough, they fired me. And told me, you were dumb enough to come back part-time. And as a part-time employee, we don't need a reason to fire you. If we say we don't need you, bye. So bye.
Okay, Sandra, is there anything else we didn't cover that you would like to say to us in this interview?
Well, to be honest with you, I probably need to do another interview with you because, you know, it's a lot of things I'd like to say that we really don't have time for. And the reason why I put it that way, I got to take my son to work. And I don't know for sure what time it is right now, but I know it's getting close to it. Yeah, that's what I figured.
Well, I do thank you for interviewing with us today.
Well, I've had a wonderful day, period. This has been a very nice day for me.
Thank you. And we will have you back.
Okay.
Thank you again, Sandra.
You're welcome.
I appreciate the interview. Appreciate talking to you.
I appreciate you taking this interview.
Appreciate your love and all that good stuff.
You're welcome.
Thank you.